The Guardian.
As long as I could keep on the pressure, you know, forget game today game. I mean, Deep Blue hasn't won a single game out of five because, again, game two I resigned when I could force a draw. Now, if somebody has another opinion, stand up and tell that the position was not a draw.
In 1997, the reigning world chess champion, Garry Kasparov, went head-to-head with a very special competitor, IBM's Deep Blue. Having tasted victory against his digital opponent the previous year, Kasparov lost the rematch, marking the first time under tournament conditions that a reigning champion had been defeated by a computer.
That could be the best human player in the world.
Much of the press that followed was predictably hyperbolic, with headlines questioning whether a Terminator scenario was just around the corner. After all, if computers can beat us at chess, how long would it be before other human skills fell to their superior powers? But as the dust settled on Deep Blue versus Kasparov and public fears subsided, experts began to pick apart the computer's moves. One concluded, when computers play chess, or for that matter, when they do anything, they do not reason. Computers, it was said, don't think, they simply calculate.
Hello, chess lovers. Let's have a look at a game played by Deep Blue Computer and Garry Kasparov.
20 years on from that momentous showdown, the potential danger posed by powerful AI is in the spotlight once again. And it's a concern that leads to the fourth and final episode of our Questioning AI mini-series, when we ask, what impact might AI have on our society? Can we teach AI to be ethical? And ultimately, does artificial intelligence need an off switch?
The biggest problems that we're facing is that AI doesn't measure things in the same way that a human being will measure things. So there isn't really a simple way to codify the decisions that a driver would make in that situation. And we haven't really found a way to do that that would be satisfactory in ethical terms.
A lot of the overblown claims around the machines might wake up tomorrow and put us out of business, this is a very long way away. But the issues that we're touching on here are here and now. They're immediate, whether it's autonomous vehicles, autonomous drones, weapons systems, whether it's the decision-making systems that underlie court decisions. These are very real.
And we have to be very careful that we don't bake into these algorithms the very biases that we've been trying to get out of our society for the last 50 or 100 years.
I'm Ian Sample. This is Questioning AI.
Hi, sorry, is that Toby?
Yeah, hi Ian.
Hi Toby, how are you?
In the field of artificial intelligence, they call it the control problem. How do we ensure that as AI becomes increasingly powerful, it doesn't inadvertently cause us harm?
But I think the development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race.
One line of work looks at off switches and big red buttons, which conjure up images of a dystopian future where AI surpasses human intelligence and enslaves or destroys us. It makes for great movies, but is it something we really need to worry about?
A discussion with all three of you here.
To help me try and answer some of these questions, I had a chat with a trio of experts, one of them via Skype.
My name is Toby Walsh. I'm a professor of artificial intelligence at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, at the Data 61 Research Lab, and a guest professor at TU Berlin.
And joining us in the studio,
Nigel Shadbolt. I'm professor of computer science at Oxford University, also principal of Jesus College, Oxford, and a visiting professor of artificial intelligence at the University of Southampton. I'm also chairman of the Open Data Institute.
I'm Yasmin Erden. I'm senior lecturer in philosophy at St Mary's University in Twickenham, and I'm also a committee member of the AISB.
To kick off, I wanted a bit of background about a field known as AI safety. I asked Toby for a simple definition.
Well, if we succeed with the goals of artificial intelligence, which myself and many of my colleagues, I think, hope, otherwise we wouldn't be working on it, then we'll build machines that are very capable, and so capable, in fact, I think that we should worry about the consequences of doing that. And AI safety is the subfield of AI, thinking about those consequences, both in the short and long term. I mean, in long term, that might be existential risk, the fact that potentially there is some threat to humanity. And in the short term, we're already, seeing some of the consequences of how machines are starting to take over aspects of our lives.
Why has this become a focus of research fairly recently?
I think in part because it's impossible to open a newspaper today and not actually see some of the progress that we are making. We do seem to be making some quite spectacular advances. There's still, though, it's worth pointing out, a huge length to go before we have machines that are as capable and then perhaps even more capable than humans. But nevertheless, even the stupid AI that we have today is starting to have impacts that have consequences, and some of them are good and some of them are bad.
What sort of problems at the moment is AI safety concentrating on? Is it all this existential risk stuff, or are there nearer term problems that people are looking to try and head off?
Oh, there's certainly many nearer term problems, and we're already seeing things like the fairness of algorithms and this idea of algorithmic discrimination being one of the really rising topics in areas like machine learning. That we do have to worry that machines that are too stupid today are be giving responsibilities, and they may be discriminating on the basis of gender, sex, and things that we don't want them to do. And we have to be very careful that we don't bake into these algorithms the very biases that we've been trying to get out of our society for the last 50 or 100 years.
Yasmin, what are the kinds of problems with AI that you see being worth sort of heading off, if you like?
Yeah, I agree, actually. I'm much more concerned about the problems that we face at the moment, including discrimination, as Toby just mentioned. I'm particularly concerned that the biases that are being incorporated into these programs represent the biases that people haven't yet faced in their own lives. So it's sort of a conversation that needs to happen on a much broader scale than simply, is the AI discriminating? Well, I think it's much more likely that the programmers are unaware of their own particular biases.
Oh, no. Well, better. I can set the stage and the case better. But so, did this aspect of Facebook's news feed, were there humans involved in changing the order of how prominent something is? And people were aghast that humans might have played a role because they all think that Facebook should just be using unbiased algorithms. But the trouble is there's no such thing as an unbiased algorithm. So I'm not really going to comment on
that. So Nigel, are the computer scientists best placed to take on these kinds of problems? Are they the ones who are best placed to identify what needs to be headed off, if you like?
Well, I think the tradition in computer science has always been to appreciate that the technology is dual use and that there will be ethical and moral questions in this. I'd like to think that technologists and engineers and scientists don't work in some kind of moral vacuum. And I think the extraordinary fact is, and the thing that we're all facing, is the doubling and doubling of power, the decreasing cost, delivers so much computing raw potential that problems that we thought were going to be hard for generations are now falling to new methods and techniques with oceans of data in ways that are truly surprising us. And I think the recognition within our own community of practice that we've got to think about the ethical dimension, that we should be thinking and talking to our students about these ethical challenges and involving a whole range of disciplines from economics to law to sociology and philosophy is very clear now. And if the existential furore, a lot of the overblown claims around the machines might wake up tomorrow and put us out of business, this is a very long way away. But the issues that we're touching on here are here and now. They're immediate, whether it's autonomous vehicles, autonomous drones, weapons systems, whether it's the decision-making systems that underlie court decisions. These are very real. Or indeed, simple things like credit scoring agencies. People have this very, very particular faith in algorithms, which those working in the field know are going to bake in all sorts of challenges.
And that's why we should be having this sort of conversation in this sort of forum, because it really is a conversation for the whole of society. It's going to impact, hard to think of bits of society it won't impact on. It's going to require skill sets of people like philosophers and psychologists and behavioral economists and a wide range of people. We have to bring them in and everyone has to be on board. So it's not just something that we computer scientists will have. I think it's going to be actually the golden age for philosophy. That philosophy is actually science finally going to have to get very practical and give us help us provide the right sort of answers to these questions in a literal enough sense that we can write programs that encode those particular answers. And of course, computers are so literal, we have to be very much more precise than perhaps philosophy has been on some of these problems in the past.
Yasmin, you're a philosopher. Is this a golden age awaiting?
Well, I mean, it should be. But I mean, part of the problem is that trying to get people to think about ethics requires that they recognise that there are ethical implications in the work that they particularly are doing. And at the moment, with technology and science more broadly, you have lots of people doing lots of very small things which may not have immediately apparent ethical issues. And that makes it very difficult then to have those conversations. I mean, not just with AI, but, you know, with engineering, with nanotechnology and the ways in which these different technologies are converging.
So do you mean that people are working on specific scientific developments almost in a vacuum, in a kind of silo? And when you add those up as an entirety, then perhaps we, as we're taught and educated in science, we don't think, okay, how does this fit in with these other things that are in development?
Absolutely. I think at the moment where the market is driving innovation, the emphasis is going to be on, you know, successful innovations that can get to market very quickly without the time, space or enthusiasm to think about the implications of every single step of that development process.
But I think, I mean, that's true. And I think that also that the academic courses, the fact that we live in a world in which interdisciplinarity is manifesting itself in lots and lots of areas, that you cannot entirely ignore the economic context in which your systems are being deployed, or if you're working in the health sector, there are existing regulation and laws. I think it's more that the people who make those regulations, the way in which our society is organized and structured to bring these norms and practices to bear, they also need to be hugely aware of where the technology is going. And a final point here is that the big issue for us here are the big beasts, the big corporates, who in some sense are larger than nation states in terms of their reach and power, and sometimes their exchequers. And the notion of what governance principles that they can bring to bear on this is going to be critical.
Research on AI safety is now so mainstream, it has its own subfield within AI. But it's a discussion that we all need to contribute to. And as Nigel points out, much of this at the moment is in the hands of the big tech firms, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon, and Apple.
I mean, Toby, do you see these existential risks that are talked about?
It's something we'll return to later on. But first, to the more dramatic existential threats. Just how worried about those should we be?
I'm much more worried about nuclear war and about climate change and about growing social inequality across the planet than I am about the existential risks posed by AI. You can never say never in science. And unless there's some fundamental reason why something couldn't happen, you always have to entertain the possibility that it could happen. But it's, as Nigel said, we're thinking about maybe a century or more away before machines could be fully as capable as humans. We're still only building narrow AI that can solve one task, and an AI that has no sentience, no consciousness. It's never going to wake up. The AI that we build today is never going to wake up and say, actually, I want to take over the planet. It's going to do what it's programmed to do. Maybe that's going to do the wrong thing, and that's, its values aren't aligned with ours. It's going to be biased in some way that we didn't intend it to be. And it's the unintended consequences of machines that I think we should worry about more than the malevolence of machines.
I think that's exactly right. It's not artificial intelligence that's going to be the existential risk immediately. It's natural stupidity. And I think that that whole notion of how we think about the unintended consequences, trying to anticipate some of those, what it means when we put these AI programs in control of our financial transactions, or have some ascendancy in safety critical contexts or in weapon systems, that's a very real. And your narrow task achieving, extraordinarily capable AIs can be dangerous to us, of course, but it's our sense of governance and control of those that is the real threat.
But Yasmin, these AIs don't need to be super intelligent before they could cause problems, presumably. I mean, the classic example is you have a self-driving car and you say, okay, get me to church as quickly as possible, and it does so without taking account of your actually arriving in a fit state. I mean, that doesn't require a superhuman intelligence.
I quite agree, actually. I think the biggest problems that we're facing is that AI doesn't measure things in the same way that a human being will measure things. So at the point at which a self-driving car is evaluating whether to take a risk that could put the nominal driver, the passenger at harm, versus the risk to the pedestrian on the pavement that they're passing, there isn't really a simple way to codify the decisions that a driver would make in that situation. And we haven't really found a way to do that would be satisfactory in ethical terms. And more than that, I mean, I agree with what the other two speakers are saying, that this sense of an AI that would want to take over the world seems incredibly unlikely until the point where we have developed an idea, A, of what it means to want things, and B, what it would look like to program things in such a way that they would want things.
Right now, questions being asked like, how did a Tesla on autopilot slam into a tractor trailer? Why didn't the built-in safety system stop it?
And do these cars threaten others on the road? ABC Action News reporter Michael Peluska in Williston, Florida tonight, digging for answers.
We have this already today with autonomous cars. If I told you that there was a drug company that was testing its product on the public without any ethical oversight, knowing that it would kill people, you would say, no, that surely can't happen. But that's what we're allowing companies like Tesla to do today. There's almost no oversight of what they do, and none of the safeguards that happens in the pharmaceutical industry are applied to developing a product that's in beta that has already killed people. Joshua Brown discovered to his cost when his Tesla killed him last year that the technology has various blind spots and limitations that were well known and yet was being tested on the public. And it's only a matter of time before it's not a Tesla driver, but an innocent member of the public that gets killed by an autonomous car.
It's interesting that you raised Tesla there, which obviously did result with that accident, where Elon Musk is one of the most vocal advocates for AI safety.
Yes, it is. There is some irony. He's also, he's also going to be responsible for putting a lot of people out of work. Anyone who's a taxi driver or a truck driver should start thinking about what other skill they have. So the unintended consequences of technology are one that Elon Musk is perhaps more than anyone on the planet as responsible for. And yet, Tesla is out there because it's an economic race. At the end of the day, someone is going to take over that billion-dollar industry of building cars. It's not necessarily going to be Toyota or Ford. It may be Tesla and Apple.
I'm much more sanguine about the future of human employment, despite all the kind of predictions of the destruction of workforces. If you actually look what's happened to human labour in the era of automation, 4 million jobs gone in automation and manufacturing in the US, and 20-odd million created in the leisure industries. You know, there's an extraordinary capacity for humans to invent new ways of doing things that attract a wage, because at the end of the day, all these automated robots, somebody's got to stand at the end of the line to buy the products they generate. So, but I do agree in the general point that we've got to be very mindful, I think, of what governance procedures that we put in place in areas where, in other sectors, as Toby points out, there's very, very severe regulation and control. And we're almost driven at Moore's law speed to kind of adopt this technology and not give it full scrutiny. A few areas in safety critical systems like aircraft where we already have existing kind of testing harness procedures, but we really need to think about this across the breadth of our deployment of these systems in society.
In 1927, the S-5, piloted by Flight Lieutenant Webster, roared to success, winning the trophy at 281 miles an hour.
The aircraft industry is a fantastic example. When we started building aircraft 100 or so years ago, it was incredibly dangerous. Planes fell out of the sky all the time. But we quickly instituted governmental safety standards and institutions that actually looked into all accidents and shared all the results amongst all the manufacturers. And so now flying is probably the safest form of transport under various measures. And that's where we really need to go with the deployment of AI into other parts of our lives and, for example, the deployment of autonomous cars.
But I think it was a very different time when aeroplanes were being developed. I think at the point where the market was still under some control to some extent, I mean, at least in the sense that things were not quite so I want to say secretive, but that makes me sound paranoid. I think at the moment what's happening with AI is a lot of money is being spent on developing AI which is not visible, which is not accessible, which is not transparent, and it's affecting, I think, what's going to happen with the way in which we use this sorts of technology and also the ways in which we understand the technology that's around us.
Right, but the market is a human-made institution. We get to actually make the rules. Corporations are an invention of the Industrial Revolution, and maybe we have to think about exactly how we change the rules to regulate them so that they are working for the public good.
I think that's a really powerful observation. I think probably we're all probably in violent agreement around the concept of how do we bring the big beasts under control. It's a bit like we have the modern equivalent of about 10 or so East India companies kind of patrolling around the world. This is not to kind of bash the great internet platforms, but to kind of, by the way in which they've become successful, we've now got to ask, how can they contribute to the public good as well as the private kind of interests that they serve? And I think that's a very big cause.
I don't think regulation is going to be sufficient to manage these problems. I think it hasn't been sufficient in other industries. Can I use the example of nanotechnology, for example? The regulation has attempted to bring under control the release of manufactured nanoparticles into the environment with very little success, actually. Manufactured nanoparticles are all around us, and we still don't quite know what they're going to do to our bodies, even though we're already ingesting them. So I'm not convinced that regulation is going to be enough. We have to also expect that everybody in this process is aware of the broader ethical issues beyond what they perceive as their minor role in this very big project.
I think that brings us back to questions not just around artificial intelligence, but around the whole use of our data economy, issues of privacy. And the thing I would just say also is that people get terribly exercised by the potential opportunities and perils of artificial intelligence. It's quite important that we recognize that, as one of the great founders of the subject said, John McCarthy, you know, today's AI is tomorrow's computer science. And there's some sense in which the magic in the box, when you actually look inside at the methods and tools, this is just a manifestation of information processing algorithms with great power and speed and data. But there isn't this sense of malign intent in the systems. And I think getting the anthropomorphism out, because we have a very natural tendency to endow these systems with our own attributes, is also quite important.
So maybe this well-versed scenario of super-intelligent overlords is nothing but an anthropomorphic nightmare. Whether it is or not, our experts seem to agree that the way in which AI is increasingly weaving itself into our daily lives is itself a cause for concern, super-intelligent or not. So maybe we do need an off switch. But is that even possible?
The kind of servers and the routers that power so much of our digital life are behind layers of deliberately reinforced security.
It's something we'll hear about after this short break. And we'll also hear about a crucial aspect of our own intelligence that would be desirable to have in AI.
I think the problem with trying to build ethics into the technology is it means that you have to face or address the inconsistency in people's everyday ethics.
We'll be right back.
Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's Here, as in hearing, and Here, as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. Before the break, we heard from Toby Walsh about some of the AI safety concerns in the here and now, biases in algorithms being just one of them. We also heard from Nigel Shadbolt about the potential existential threats to humanity by superintelligent AIs. The scenarios are surely worrying, but perhaps they can be a distraction from more immediate matters. How should the AI marketplace be regulated? And how do we get big tech genuinely to behave in a socially responsible manner? It's a burden of responsibility that philosopher Yasmin J. Erden thinks goes much further than big tech companies and regulations. She argues that ethical implications should be considered on each and every level of the production process, meaning there is a role to play by scientists, programmers, and even the public.
A massive discussion, but it is there, about whether these systems might...
But what if we can't guarantee that AI will behave as intended? Some scientists in the field have argued for an off switch or some other means of ultimate control. But is that really necessary?
I would say absolutely, particularly where the technology is going to have a direct impact on people's lives, such as, for instance, machines, autonomous machines, or even semi-autonomous machines, which are involved in conflict, in wars, whether those are drones or artificial soldiers. There has to be the chance to turn those machines off.
I think the idea of an off switch is perhaps a little too simplistic. There are actually already computer systems that we have that we can't turn off. Air traffic control, the banking system, the nuclear power station control software. There's actually lots of software that we don't ever want it to stop. I mean, your computer flying your plane, we definitely want never to stop. So I think it's a bit simple to just think our problems are solved just by thinking about, we've got to have a big red button that we can press at some point, and then all will be safe. But we have to think more carefully about ethics by design, that we build systems that will always behave in the ways that we intend and the unintended consequences are ones that we can put up with.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think a hyper-complex digital environment is not something you can just switch off with one big switch. In fact, it's not designed to be like that. The kind of servers and the routers that power so much of our digital life are behind layers of deliberately reinforced security, and the exact question of who has the power to turn the switch is one that is important, should be debated, should be understood who has, even if you should wish to, any power or authority over these systems. And then the unintended consequences of switching off and then realizing the cascade effects. If you think brownouts are a problem, you can imagine what happens when, as we saw with unintended fallovers, when YouTube goes down, a whole bunch of cascades followed from that. So I think what it calls for is a lot of research on the deep interdependency of these hyper-complex digital systems.
You raised the issue of ethics and whether these kinds of systems should have some kind of ethical framework programmed into them. Is that something that's a valid sort of proposition? Is that possible? Would that be effective, do you think?
I don't think we don't fully understand how to do this today, but it's certainly something that we need to think about how we're going to do it in the future. That's why AI safety is such a burgeoning area of research.
What do you think, Yasmin? Is ethics an area that you can program into a system, or is it actually you have to go at designing these systems just with simpler rules that they just try not to harm people, you try and build in redundancy so they don't go wrong very often?
I think the problem with trying to build ethics into the technology is it means that you have to face or address the inconsistency in people's everyday ethics. So with the self-driving car, for example, you wouldn't necessarily want to hold someone responsible if, in the attempt to avoid hitting someone who steps out into the road, they drive onto the pavement and they hit somebody else by accident. But there is no way that you could program that level of detail into a car that would be acceptable. And that's always going to be problematic.
And it's going to be culture specific as well.
Absolutely.
I think there are other ways of getting ethical control, though. I think that one thing that's being considered, and there are different views about whether this is indeed feasible, is the equivalent of a digital Geneva Convention. And this is quite seriously being talked about in terms of, yes, AI is a dual-use technology. When we've seen this in nuclear, biological and chemical, nation states have come to a view about how they should or shouldn't deploy this weaponry. And we see that certainly in offensive cyber attack at the moment, people sort of thinking, well, how long can this continue? But that's a conversation that's ongoing. And the other way into this is to think about the raw material for AI, which is the data itself. And there we can certainly think about ethical guidelines and frameworks in which the permissioning and use of data is quite carefully and appropriately controlled. And I think we do have models in existence for that.
As Nigel points out, data is crucial for modern AI systems, and it's information we all provide, even if we don't realize it. So could it be that AI safety should ensure we're safe not only physically, but digitally too, by protecting our data and our privacy?
This digital ape that we are, the issues are, what expectations to privacy can we reasonably have? I mean, to simply give up on it because we somehow have lots of sensors around us is entirely the wrong approach. We have to think very hard about how, despite the fact that authorities and organizations may know something about me, they can't use it against me. We understand this in all sorts of existing legislation, from age discrimination to using gender in making an employment decision. So how we determine that we will govern and organize ourselves, whether it's from democracy or the equity of choice, is exactly the right conversation to have.
Toby, in Android Dreams, your recent book on AI, when you look at the future and talk through the issues you see coming with AI, you look at privacy, you look at what it means for us in the future. What are the things that sort of kept you awake when you were looking at that?
Well, I'm very worried about how it's affecting our political discourse. I think it's having a very corrosive effect, and there is, you know, other factors feeding into that at the moment. But we, you know, we don't want to wake up in a world which is a dystopian, that's painted by I think, you know, George Orwell, in which, you know, the people with the better algorithms are winning the debates, and we want the better ideas to be winning, not the better algorithms, the people with the better data. And so we do have to think about, you know, whether this needs perhaps more regulation and education. I'm still immensely surprised how people, you know, were surprised that their emails were being read. Well, of course they were being read. They're, you know, what's the most machine-readable form of text? It's an email. It's not your phone call. So the surprise that people had that they had to worry about their privacy is also, you know, worrying and distressing.
I think part of the issue is that it's starting to make us aware that privacy is not what people always value most, which is not to say that it's not valued. I think the expectations in the earlier days of computing was that people would take care about their own privacy because that would matter to them. And in fact, people didn't, because in fact, lots of other things matter, such as the need to connect to people, the need to share, the need to present oneself well to the world. So there is something really important about thinking about privacy, particularly in relation to ethics and the ways in which people live their lives. But we also need to think about it in terms of the role that it plays in people's lives and the fact that we haven't quite understood that yet. And in fact, privacy as a concept is quite a recent notion. I mean, it wasn't until quite recently that people had their own rooms, they had their own apartments. Until quite recently, people were 5, 6, 10 people to a house. The expectation of privacy was pretty low. So I'm not really surprised that as a relatively new concept, we haven't quite got our heads around it yet.
But of course, originally, one of the motivating concepts around privacy was the notion of having autonomy, having a space where you could discuss or entertain disputatious or heretical ideas or different ideas in a political discourse. So I think that you can argue that once upon a time we had different physical sensors, but that's not to say that this construct isn't really important to a political dialogue. And I think the idea of how we allow the quality of the idea and the evidence and the argument to kind of also matter in a modern social media context is important.
But I don't think the issue is that we neglect autonomy, for example, just as I'm saying that we shouldn't neglect privacy. I'm saying that if we don't understand that people will sacrifice both autonomy and privacy in order to fulfill certain other basic human needs, then we're not going to understand why people are reacting to technology in the way that they are. Of course people have Alexa in their house. It's entertaining, and entertainment is really important to people.
Carlos Correa is live in our newsroom to show us how to use the new voice command technology without draining your bank account. Pretty important, Carlos.
Yeah, the device is pretty awesome. The microphone's ability to pick up the word Alexa being spoken at almost any volume and from almost anywhere around your house is remarkable, unless, of course, hundreds of dollars worth of unwanted merchandise shows up on your doorstep.
But are people sacrificing their privacy knowingly? or are they doing it without realizing what the quid pro quo is?
I think they're doing it with some awareness of a sacrifice, but without awareness of quite how much they're sacrificing. And I'm not convinced that education is enough, because they think even if you explain to someone how much they're giving away, I'm not convinced that will change their behavior. So I think we also have to be mindful that we can't just rely, again, I'm wary of just relying on regulation, or wary of just relying on people making decisions for themselves about their privacy.
I think we really also need to worry about enforcing better corporate behaviour. When people started to become concerned about underage people accessing Facebook, the reaction of Facebook should not be to build a new app so that underage people can access the service. The reaction of Facebook should have been that, okay, well, let's try and police this. Let's try and keep these people who are very innocent and malleable minds and protect them, not actually try and lure them into our system.
Just how much does the online giant really know about us? Well, Facebook is more popular than ever. In fact, studies show people are checking it on average about 14 times every day, and users are noticing something kind of odd.
Yeah, a topic they just talked about is finding its way into their Facebook feed. Have you ever noticed that?
It would seem then that all our experts are in agreement about the need for better standards and practices when it comes to how our data are used. But pinning down who is responsible for taking meaningful action is no easy feat. And the complexity of this issue doesn't stop there.
Before I let you all get off, I would like to get...
Tie this into the bigger picture of AI safety, which includes threats further down the line, and the idea of an off switch starts to become a little fuzzy. Could it be, then, that what we really need is for researchers building AI to be switched on to all aspects of AI safety? And there are plenty of them. Before I let them go, I asked our trio of experts what, if anything, about AI keeps them up at night.
It's hard to put my finger on one thing, but there's one topic that we haven't discussed in much detail that I think we really ought to deserve the public's attention, and that's the idea of autonomous weapons, that there will be a revolution in warfare, and that we can't build machines that can make the right moral distinctions today to decide who lives and who dies, and that there will be an arms race. We're starting to see that happen today. And this is something that we really have to worry about in the very near future. It's not Terminator, but autonomous drones that could be infecting our lives.
And how far off do you see that technology? And also, is there not regulation already around it that would prevent that, as our own Foreign and Commonwealth Office believe?
Well, there's existing international humanitarian law, but at the end of the day, these would be weapons of mass destruction. You'd allow one programmer to do what previously 1,000 soldiers did. In my books, that counts as a weapon of mass destruction. Every other weapon of mass destruction has specialized legislation. We now have prohibited nuclear weapons, biological weapons, chemical weapons, all the other weapons of mass destruction. It was decided that it was appropriate and necessary to have separate legislation, a UN treaty to ban them. And that's why I'm very passionate about the idea that we should be thinking about banning autonomous weapons as well.
Well, I'm afraid Toby beat me to the punch, so I'll have to pick my second, which would be about data privacy and the regulation of the new technologies and existing technologies, which would require, as I say, not just regulation, but greater understanding. So it wouldn't be one type of technology, but the way in which these different technologies are converging.
How are we going to do that? How are we going to get these people to do the right thing?
Well, I think it would be really helpful if the way in which engineers and scientists and computer scientists are trained included real ethical training. And I don't just mean learning to complete ethical forms.
Nigel, have they left anything for you to suggest?
Well, I think the idea of data being one of the kind of key ingredients here, and one of the things that we have been working on in other efforts at the Open Data Institute is the whole idea of trying to find ways in which data can serve a public good. And it's not just the algorithms, the AI algorithms in possession of either government, state actors, or big business. It's the fact that so much of the data is within a particular corporate ownership. And I think if there's one thing, it's if there is a real inequity, it is the fact that states and big business can do lots and lots with your data, but you have relatively little power to control or understand or influence what's done with your own. And I think that's a cause that I believe is going to get significantly larger as we think about the drivers in all of this.
Perhaps the most revolutionary development of recent years has been that of the computer, because for the first time we've discovered a machine that can substitute, at least in part, for the human brain. Before that, it was just a matter of saving human muscles.
Special thanks this week to Toby Walsh, Nigel Shadbolt, and Yasmin J. Erden. And thanks to all our other contributors to this Questioning AI miniseries. If you want to find out more about any of these topics, we'll include links to Toby's book, Android Dreams, as well as Nigel's upcoming book, The Digital Ape, in the episode's description on the Guardian website. If you've got any questions, queries, or feedback, please get in touch via our email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
And we don't know what further discoveries may tell us not only about the universe, but about our own technology.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.